You're listening to Jameis After Midnight.
Warning. The following program contains adult language and discussions involving the horror genre. Listener discretion is advised.
All right, you are listening to Jameis After Midnight. This is Jameis Wilkes, and I am here at the Chateau de Schlossberg. I will be interviewing Josh Schlossberg. Good evening, Josh.
Thanks for coming. I'm excited.
Thank you. Thank you for having me over. Wow, this is great. This is my first interview for this podcast. Josh, I met you through Denver Horror Writers, which would later become the Denver Horror Collective. But let's go back a little bit, and then we'll talk some about you and your writing. And what I'd like to know, first off, what was interesting is when I first became involved with Denver Horror Writers, I found out through Facebook, you know, it was a Facebook group, and discovered you guys had been meeting at different locations throughout the city. What I wanted to ask was, how did this all start? Now, you and I have talked before, and I have a rough idea on it. Mm-hmm. If you don't mind sharing, what caused you to start Denver Horror Writers?
So it was, I believe, way back in 2017. Part the mists of time. So, but prior to that, so there was the Georgetown, it was a ghost town writers retreat. It was something that was going on in the mountains and had a lot of horror writers there. And I met a few folks who were writing horror, and including Gary Roby, who will be on this podcast at some point as well. And I met Zach Hennessy as well there, and some other folks, Catherine Spader, folks who ended up creating the group originally. But anyway, so that there was a germ in my mind for a little while about creating something horror-like, maybe just a critique group. And after going to this particular writer's retreat, I realized there were some other folks who I could maybe start this up with. But rewinding a bit more, I was in a critique group, and I was bringing in my weird stories about viruses impregnating people and vampire bedbugs and weird stuff like that. And people would be polite in this critique group, and like, oh, very good writing, Josh, but I could tell they weren't into it, and they gave me some good critiques sometimes, but they didn't like the genre. And then finally, a story that I put out very recently called Hangina, which you know a fellow named the Riprock who designed the cover. So I was bringing that to the critique group, and basically one person was like, I couldn't even finish it, I was so grossed out by it. A few other people just, I could tell, were just off put. And here's the thing, it's actually, despite the title, somewhat tame for horror. I would call it like horror light, if that. It's more like weird fiction.
Having read it, I would concur, but yes, continue.
No big deal, right? Yeah. Anyway, after that, I was kind of like, screw this group. And no offense to the individuals that were in it, a lot of the folks were really good. They just weren't into my type of writing, and I realized for me to get useful feedback, I needed to be amongst people who actually loved the genre, or at least even tolerated the genre. So then when I was at that Ghost Town writers thing, and I met a couple other folks, I was like, well, maybe we can actually make this happen. And then as simple as, in this day and age, starting up a Facebook group, and we had the first core group of four folks, and then people started coming in and coming in, and now, yeah, the Facebook group, we have many dozens of folks. We have about 15 folks who are regularly active, and then we've expanded it into not just the horror group or the writers group, but also the book club that you run and a few other things. So that's basically the origin of the whole thing. Just people can't handle horror sometimes, and you want the aficionados perspective when you're trying to improve your work.
Right. Too often I hear, and I say too often, there is some wisdom in this, but I've got my own perspective on it. If you want to read and or if you want to write good horror, you need to read outside of your genre.
Right.
I agree with to a point. You also need to know, especially if those who are more interested on the horror commercial fiction side, You have to read in your market. You have to see what's out there, what's going on. I may not necessarily lean that way, but I might at some time. And if I am, I'm going to do my research, and I'm going to read gads and gads of what I would call more mainstream horror. Right now, I'm not at that point. I'm much more interested in the artistic realm. What I've picked up from you, and you can tell me if I'm accurate on this observation, is you've got a focus right now on your writing. Yes, money is good. Checks are good. I will never, if somebody wants to pay me something, for writing something, chances are never will I turn it down. you seem dedicated to your craft, and I don't see you inquiring on the commercial end so much. What's your take on that? I mean, we're kind of in a market right now with franchises. There's a huge focus on horror television right now because of streaming is just overwhelming cinema. Well, it's already happened. I mean, from what I'm getting from the market out there, filmmakers are, it's kind of a labor of love, but they're not really seeking to make their fortune.
For sure.
All of that to say, what approach are you taking, I guess, right now, currently with your writing?
Yeah, I guess I don't think about that too much. I mean, whether I'm writing literary horror, commercial horror, mainstream. A previous novel I wrote was basically literary fiction, which I'm not saying was a mistake, but I know is very hard to place in the world. And I think it was more because it didn't have a specific genre. It kind of was at the edge of horror and whatnot. Anyway, I tried to put it out there, tried to get some agents. I got some small publishers interested, but not the right one, so I've trunked that. So after that, I did kind of accept, I got to at least position myself within a genre, so the genre of horror, even though my stuff does kind of go out a little bit. But in terms of whether, you know, commercial, literary, I love the written word. I started as an awful, awful poet, but really about the word choice, so that kind of obsessed me. And then I got into fiction writing, and then I got into journalism, which kind of tightened up my stuff. So now these days I'm writing a lot of fiction. Do I consider it, am I trying to have commercial appeal? I'm just writing the stuff that's in my head and that I feel passionate about and that comes out. I hope it can have a certain amount of appeal, that's for sure. I'm not foreseeing my stuff being up on the big screen right now. I'm not sure that the stuff that I'm writing would translate into that. But who knows? You know, I'm not going to constrain myself one way or another in terms of I'm only writing literary horror, or no, I definitely want to kind of make it simple so everyone can take a bite out of it. Mm. So I'm not really even sure what one would call it right now, but I can only write the stuff that is in my head that I have to get out, and I feel like if I keep writing enough of it, it'll appeal to someone.
Yep, it certainly will. It's kind of where I'm at with my writing. I would much rather write what I want to write, and although it's harder to go this route, try and find my quote-unquote market, you know, that way. Find if it resonates, you know, with somebody else, or if it catches on, or if someone, even just the reader-holic, you know, who's out there who will read most anything horror, and there's lots of them out there. But yes, well, excellent. So I came to know you first as a horror writer. So who is Josh Schlossberg? And by that, are you a writer, are you an author, are you a reporter, a journalist?
Huh.
Do you have the ego and the fortitude to be all of those? What
The ego might be there. So you want me to define myself? No. I'm a writer. I put words together sometimes in ways that make sense. A lot of times, no, which is why I have to be an editor as well and edit my own stuff. Mm. But I'm just trying to figure out how I can put the written word into a form that has meaning to myself and also resonates with the world. And at the same time, I can get some of my propaganda out as well. Like, I have weird ideas, and I would like others to see. I just like to see if it clicks with them, and if not, that's cool. But I have a feeling that I have a few thoughts that other people might be into, and I found that to be the case. So however I can get it out there, I'm fine with that. Journalism I do because, well, I at least thought for a while that that's what people wanted. I'm realizing now that they don't actually want journalism so much. They do want propaganda. So I'm actually pulling back from journalism for a little bit right now, and I'm focusing on a few things, and the fiction is one of them. So telling the stories, and frankly, I don't even necessarily care how I get the stories out, but right now, yeah, if I could do one thing, it would be, you know, as a horror writer, horror author, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And if other opportunities present themselves, I have no problem dabbling in that. It may be that a nonfiction book is really what gets my stuff out there. But right now, telling stories, I think, is the most, I love it the most. I love reading stories. And I think that it might actually be the best way to convey information to people, because if you're an activist and you're like, you should care about this, people are like, either they do or they don't to begin with. If you're a journalist, you're like, here are my facts. But people also are not necessarily swayed by facts. They're swayed by what they already believe. But a story, you can get out a concept or an idea, and kind of it's like a pill that you put into peanut butter so your dog will swallow it down.
Right.
So I guess my stuff is a combination of all of that.
All right. Well, okay, so here's a question I hadn't planned on, but I'm very curious to get your take on it. And I promise you, dear listeners, that I'm not preaching with this question. But I want to ask it. Is journalism a lost art?
Is it a lost art? I think people know how to do it, so it's not like it's not understood how to put out good journalism, but I think that the demand for that particular, quote, art form has died down tremendously, which leads the purveyors of that to put out something else. And, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff out there is it's basically creative nonfiction. It's not journalism, and it's also a bit of advocacy. And as a former organizer and activist, I don't have a problem with advocacy, but I think you gotta, there are genres, there are compartments, and I think we should have some firm lines there. And so, yeah, I do despair for journalism, but good thing I can just make up a bunch of stuff and turn it into a story as well, a horror story. So all is not lost.
Excellent. Okay, this question is interesting, so I am going to qualify it a little bit. What literary pilgrimages have you gone on? And now, a literary pilgrimage, this can be, and when I ask that question, this can be a number of things.
Okay.
It could be a trip to Baltimore to the Edgar Allan Poe house. It could be taking the same road trip. It could be doing the Jack Kerouac thing. And frame that however you want. Was there a particular literary pilgrimage that you've ever done?
Sort of. Yeah, I would say sort of. So I'm more interested in landscapes than people. That sounds horrible. I care about people. I care about you, John. I'm glad that people are in this world, and I'm one of them.
And you've got my attention with the word landscapes, because we're going to talk a little bit later about folklore. And
beautiful.
I'm telling you that it all starts with landscapes in that realm.
Nice.
Anyway, continue.
Yeah, so the combination between interest, a mild interest in people, and you know, a severe interest in the landscape. So I moved out to Colorado about 5 years ago, and I become obsessed with the deserts, so the southwestern deserts. And what partially got me into that was a writer named Ed Abbey, who has written both fiction and nonfiction. So his nonfiction is just kind of railing about destruction of wilderness, and then also his own weird quirky take, which was basically like a redneck environmentalist, because that was the breed that they used to be back in the day. And so he wrote a lot of books. He wrote a book called Desert Solitaire, which is about Arches National Park back in the 50s, and him despairing about how it was turning into a playground. So that was 70 years ago, if the math holds in my head. Anyway, so he got me to kind of see the desert as not just this barren, boring landscape, but actually what had become to me the most gorgeous landscape that's almost like some of the last magic left in the world. And this was a guy who's been obsessed with forests his whole life, but the desert became a real thing for me. And he's also written several novels as well. And through his eyes, I was able to see the beauty of the desert, and then through all these place names that he put in the book that just were kind of like, you know, Land's End or The Maze, I visited a lot of those places, and I would take the book with me.
Wow.
And I feel like he would also give me courage to kind of do some things that were actually not responsible. Like, I go off in the wilderness alone too far at the wrong times of the year, but I would read the book and I'd be like, I'm thinking I should turn back. I'm like, I'm way out there. This is kind of scary. And it's like, oh, well, Ed walked through, you know, 100 miles of wilderness. What I found out later is that a lot of his stuff was exaggerated, and he wasn't really doing those things necessarily. So he was causing me to put myself more at risk than I probably should have been. But he gave me that courage. And so I would say that's the closest to a literary pilgrimage. It's, I go out to the Southwest. I mean, I guess we're technically at the edge of the Southwest already, southwestern Colorado. But I go out every few months to the desert. I've probably been out, you know, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, places like that. In the last 5 years, probably like 25 times. Like, I go out a lot. And I always have Ed Abbey's stories and his words and his places in the back of my mind.
Outstanding. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. So I literally grew up in the desert.
Yeah.
Bringing that, you know, into our discussion, into a horror podcast, it's just such, what's interesting is talking about desert and then mentioning the words, it's fertile ground for
yes, right,
for
right.
horror. Now, that's not a disparaging remark about where I grew up. I mean, it's incredible history. What I find amusing, I was having a discussion with you before I turned the recorder on here about, I've been diving into podcasts. Mm-hmm. I promise I have a point to all this. There's a particularly great podcast that the Brits do. It's British-based, and it's called The Evolution of Horror. Anyway, that when in their talk about folklore and things like that, what's kind of interesting is, and they're not, they do not overtly bash Americans on the show. However, they kind of sort of think of us as a teenage country without much history, and then they just talk about English countryside and English this, and it's so rich with this ancient history and how the indigenous peoples were done wrong. I'm like, okay, you do realize you're talking about the United States, where, okay, we didn't show up here on July 3rd, 1776, and you know,
yeah.
There's a we have our own haunted history about, to say the least, as far as our history with indigenous peoples and that whole realm. Anyway, my whole point is the Southwest is like, it is rich with history. In fact, I'm going to make a plug for Southwest Gothic. Adrian Montoya's podcast is all about that, you know, and there's different types of legends and folklore along that border. So when you're telling me about this literary pilgrimage, it brought back all kinds of memories growing up. I mean, the Southwest is amazing. It's a geological motherlode, you know, literally.
Yep.
And the in fact, flying over the Grand Canyon, I had the feeling that I was looking at a organism. You know, it looks like the main artery and veins and capillaries to a living being. You know, it's one of the most incredible. It's almost surreal. It's almost like you have this feeling that you're looking at something fake, you know, from Disney, and then you realize, no, that is a big giant.
I mean, it is alive. The Colorado River is basically the lifeblood of that whole region.
Absolutely. But, you know, my mom, she has a pulse on that. She gets excited every time we have snow here.
Yeah.
She's like, well, that means more water for us. You know, that she reminds me, you know, every time. So
luckily we had a good snowpack this year, and so less drought downstream.
Right. All right. Well, that was amazing. Let's talk a bit about horror. What is the first book that scared the crap out of you?
Well, my mom was into Stephen King, so I don't know if she read me Stephen King in bed. That would be weird, right? I know she read Tolkien to me, and I think that's more...
It would be both weird and awesome, but anyway.
I don't think she did, but she had the books lying around, and probably the first one that I read, you know, now thinking back, was probably Night Shift, but I don't remember the specifics of that. It was the first story, and then it was also the movie, I have to say. Was, and this is pertinent today, is Pet Sematary. And, you know, so there's the remake of the movie. You know, I read the book and then saw the movie, and that traumatized me at probably age 12 to the point where I watched it at my grandparents' house in New Jersey. And I hope I was younger than 12, but I might have actually been 12, maybe a little bit younger. I made my grandfather sleep in the room because it scared me so much.
Wow.
So it was a combination of the book and the movie, so that might be cheating a little bit on the answer.
Oh, I get you. And also, you know, those memories from the past, sometimes it's hard to separate one from the other. And interesting you mentioned that. Pet Sematary, that was the one that got its hooks into me for horror. Now, I read Peter Straub's Ghost Story, and if somebody told, you know, put a gun to my head and said, pick your favorite horror author, and I absolutely had to choose it, I would probably fall on Peter Straub.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of literary fiction. Anyhow, loved Ghost Story, but horror really got its hooks into me because the next book I read was Pet Sematary by Stephen King.
Yeah.
So is there a particular element or scene? Is it hard to pick one?
No, I mean, should we give spoilers since the new movie is coming out?
Yes, this is a very spoilery show.
I mean, that book came out, like 40 years ago? It's like, if you haven't read a book that's been out for 40 years, it's like, sorry, how long are you supposed to wait?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the dead kid element was probably the main part of that. Yep. And then I don't remember it as much in the book. I know it was there, but I remember in the movie the Zelda character with like misshapen components to her body and kind of kept up in the attic. That, I was I was going to say, I wasn't a fan of Zelda, but I kind of was. Like, that really intrigued me, the idea of just this, you know, misused, displaced member of the family that we kind of push out of sight, out of mind. I've actually for years been thinking of ways to incorporate a similar concept into one of my books, especially when I heard of a friend of mine who had not quite a Zelda situation, but an almost Zelda situation. I was like, whoa, that could be real. So I think it was that combination of just, like, kids aren't supposed to die and kind of distorted family members that got to me.
Yeah, Zelda is definitely a... I would say that that's the first thing that really begins to haunt that book. and that story. I mean, you're given a glimpse almost right from the get-go, but...
And I just want to say, so there's a combination. I mean, the dead kid comes back to life, and then there's just a very real... So it's like, you know, in horror fiction, I always try to, especially early on, maybe put in some creepy elements, but they're kind of real-life stuff, you know, and then you kind of ease into, well, maybe this is supernatural. So I think in Pet Sematary, you know, just the Zelda with, you know, severe scoliosis or whatever she had, you know, that can be believable. That can happen in your life. I don't know how many dead kids are coming back from a Native American cemetery, but I've never tried.
Right. So I think it was spinal meningitis.
Was it? Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense than scoliosis.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, now, based on your experience so far, let's talk a little bit about the publishing industry itself. And I know we've had a few conversations
Calm
about this.
Calm down, Josh. Okay.
Now, I know, I don't know if this is a, there's so many, you could throw a dart and hit one, or if there's one that, that comes to the forefront. Whatever it takes, go ahead and think of one. In your mind, when I ask you the question, what is the most unethical practice in the publishing industry, what comes screeching to the front right now, this second?
Well, that's not fair. I'm not going to tell you what's exactly on my... No. I would say I get a little bit miffed by... It's just the industry itself. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to take it away from the individuals who are just playing what works financially for them, and I understand
right.
that. So I read a recent piece, and it kind of summed up some issues around, I mean, agents, right? So you kind of need an agent to go with the big publishers. And so this is the second novel
right.
that I've written. This is one I think that has legs. It's a novel I just wrote, Alpha Syndrome. I'm putting out to agents right now. So I'm trying to go the traditional route. I'm totally okay with... I'm also querying smaller publishers, so not requiring agents. So I'm seeing what makes the most sense. But I feel like right now with agents, they kind of have to be going for like that slam dunk or the grand slam, to combine sports analogies for no reason. And so the big publishers just want a very narrow kind of writing. So what it ends up doing is it's knocked out the mid-list writers. And I would someday like to be a great, amazing, famous top seller writer, but I don't need to be, and I just want an audience. And I believe my audience is out there, and I've actually already proven to myself that my audience is out there. I need to expand it a bit.
Right.
But what happens is when you're only going for the big guys, because big guys and gals, for the publishing houses to make any sort of income, that's what they have to do. It's got to be like this amazing bestseller. So the agents are just going for what is the most broad brush, basically. I mean, obviously good quality, competent stuff, but it's like, what's the most likely to get across the broad swaths of society? And knowing what I know about psychological development, everyone's at different levels. So the only way to get to everyone is to kind of simplify stuff. And I'm not saying I'm so highbrow or anything like that. And I'm actually learning to do a little better job of kind of not pigeonholing myself too much. But I think that it's difficult to be just a good writer on the rise and really have much of a chance out there. And so I think that's a bit of a bummer. But the good thing is there are plenty of smaller publishers, indie publishers, there's self-publishing,
right.
all of those options, you know, like I've talked before about, you know, the gatekeepers, and they have their preferences and whatnot. It's like you create your own gate is what you do. So that's how I'm trying to take a situation that is just like, it's not like agents don't want other stuff out there. They're trying to make a living, and that's what the industry has become. You know, it's kind of
right.
become like you got to swing for the fences.
What's interesting is what's going on in the economy is what's going on with Hollywood, is what's going on with publishing, is what's going on with everywhere. And it's a lot of polarizing, for better or for worse. And I say for better. My own observation right now is we're seeing much more of the artists doing it because they love it.
Yeah.
There's just, there are guys who are like, no, I don't want to create quote-unquote content. I want to make a movie. I want to create a film. I want to have a story in it. I need to get a writer. You know, I need to. I want to get a crew together. And it's not just a nostalgia thing. This goes all the way. We're humans. Like we started telling stories around a fire. We've kept it going for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So the polarizing is. It seems like I've heard it phrased out there. You're either making a Marvel movie or you are on the other end. Of the budget, you know, you're either spending $10 million or you're spending $100 million.
Right.
There's very little in between. In fact, when you see figures of like $20 and $40 million, people kind of like turn their heads. They're like, you just don't hear that budget anymore.
Yeah.
So it's I think the same thing has happened in publishing. Now in publishing, we're not talking about millions. We're talking, and then my whole point being is there's this view from mainstream publishing. It's been out there for one or two decades now. When self-publishing began to get some traction, you remember how they used to call them vanity presses? I mean, yeah. It was just they got trashed relentlessly, yeah. You know, and then there were a few writers who were like, they did a pretty good job editing their own work. They did a pretty good job marketing their own work. They did a pretty good job presenting themselves, and they were able to break out and do it all. Well, the tack that mainstream publishing now takes is, but that's so rare. It's like winning the lottery. Well, you know what? Getting James Patterson level sales, that's right. Like winning the lottery. You know, there's no, they want to dangle that, you know.
Yeah.
Carrot out there and just keep telling you the whole time, well, it's right. It's attainable, come this way. You know, it's like, well, if I'm going to chase a carrot
right
now, it's going to be through self-publishing.
Yeah, no, and I totally agree. And I think you phrased the original question unethical. I guess I don't necessarily consider it unethical, but I think it's a shame. And I think here's the question. A lot of past literature that has been put out in the world that is appreciated decades later, are we creating more of that these days with the process that's going on with big publisher? I don't know. We might be. There's some great stuff that's coming out there, but I'm being more on the lookout for kind of the stuff that's fallen through the cracks and some of the smaller publishers, and I think they're filling the void, and the fact that the big publishing houses are kind of getting into self-publishing, which is weird, I think that shows that it's going in another direction. So, yeah, right. We don't necessarily need people to, you know, say our work is okay and then present it to somebody else. We can kind of do it ourselves if the audience is out there. And if the audience is not out there, that's the final arbiter. And I'm fine if somebody's like, hey, man, you know that weird stuff you write about, like, cat diseases? Like, no one in the world wants to read it. And then that's the day I'll think about stopping writing it.
All right. Now, on a more personal level, does writing energize or exhaust Josh Schlossberg?
Oh, definitely both. I mean, coming up with ideas, you know, everything from this weird half-sleep, half-awake state to going hiking in the mountains on my weekly hike where a lot of my ideas come out. I mean, that's super energizing. And then just piecing the story together and putting it out there. But, you know, the writing itself can be arduous. I mean, there are certain parts of the process that I enjoy more than others, and as I get more proficient at it, I'm actually finding it's more and more easier to put out a product, but there's a bit of torture and labor involved that can be, you know, draining in the sense that a good long hike or a workout's draining. It's like, I know it's good for me, but it's still, you know, it could be a little bit rough on the joints.
Speaking of rough on the joints, what are some common traps for new writers, and if you've got any specifically for new horror writers? By the way, I like to use that word new. You and I have had conversations where I hate that word aspiring. Okay, you're either writing or you're not.
I agree.
You know, everyone out there listening to this, if you're writing, you are a writer. Mm-hmm. Granted, there's different degrees of success, you know, however you measure that, absolutely. But if you are writing, you are a writer. Sorry, Josh, we'll get back to this.
No, I think that's an important point, and I agree completely.
So what are some common traps for new writers / horror writers?
Well, in many ways, I am a new horror writer, and all I have to do is look at all the traps I have fallen into and continue to fall into, and I could say that would be a pretty damn long list. But I'm not even sure I'm in the position where I can advise. But I mean, here I will tout my own modest success, and it's that out of 6 short stories I wrote, I was able to sell 5 of them, not to big places, not for much money, but get them out there. And, you know, so I feel like that gives myself a little credibility in terms of not whether I'm a good writer or not, but that other people tolerate my works and might want to read it. So that's a start, right? Anyway, so I think some of the traps, I mean, that I've fallen into just involve, I think you can both aim too high and too low at the same time. And I'm not sure which one I'm currently guilty of. I mean, I've gotten some good advice from people, I don't know if it's good yet, basically saying there's no reason you shouldn't consider that you might be a full-time horror writer who sells your novels and is making a living doing that. Like,
right.
I'm like, well, I'll leave some space for that. And then there's people who are like, hey, man, don't be an idiot and make sure you have, you know, your well-paying job or decent-paying job, right, and are making a go at that. So I've kind of vacillated back and forth between the different aspects, and I think I found a decent balance where I am not going all in any direction, as in I'm not quitting all my jobs and just writing novel after novel and hoping that'll make it do. And at the same time, I'm not like, well, I'm going to put aside my pen for a little while and get back to it. I'm continuing. I basically spend, I mean, right now, my secret. So basically just an hour and a half, 5 days a week of actual writing. And then I'm constantly thinking about the writing and plotting stuff and all that and researching and practicing right. All sorts of stuff like that. But so I would say maybe a trap is, yeah, going too far in either direction, being overly zealous and thinking that for sure this is going to make you your fortune. And at the same time, giving too much into skepticism and not putting in time in your craft.
Mm, excellent. Okay. Now in that whole in developing a calculus for horror writing, this certainly might be an element. Define this however you want, by the way, when I ask this. Does a big ego help or hurt horror writers?
As someone who sometimes has an ego about certain things, basically I get an ego when I feel threatened. So when I'm not feeling threatened, I'm not too much of an egotist. Different things threaten me. I would say you need to know when to step into your ego and when to transcend it, if right. That's possible. And it's funny because very recently I've been trying to get myself to, you know, it gets a little heady and kind of like Eastern sort of religion stuff, but, you know, going beyond your ego and, you know, there's a way of going beyond your ego as in not being an asshole, not being an egotist, selfish just about yourself, and then looking at the greater world. But then there's the concept of, like, none of us really exist. And I'm not going to get all esoteric and stuff like that, but I've recently, as of this last week, I watched some video online talking about, like, an ego backlash. And it's like you start making a lot of progress in your life, and then you start, something slips back, and then you're kind of back in a little bit more of a primitive self. And I recently was that way because I had some stuff going on, and that kind of shoved me back. So what I've been trying to do as a response is to kind of at least conceptualize the idea of, like, none of us really exist. You know, we're these organisms, we're these beings on the planet. I'm no different than other people. That kind of stuff. I don't quite understand that or know if that's true, but I've been trying to think in that term. And I recently today was thinking, is that actually going to make my writing better or worse? And I don't know the answer. It could be that I just become so lucid and a part of just the flow that I'm like, what's the point of me writing a horror story anymore?
Right.
But I don't think I'm about to be enlightened anytime soon, so I'm not worrying about it too much. But yeah, find that balance.
Yeah.
Step into it when you need to. But yeah, think of the world beyond yourself and think about it this way. It's like your ego can't prosper. You yourself can't prosper in a world that does not take into account individuals, right? Various different individuals. So you can't just fight for yourself. You've got to fight for the whole world. That's the way I look at it. And
right.
Whatever that means, it's anyone's guess.
Hey, we're writers. We deal with metaphors and analogies all the time, so.
And sometimes I just make up bullshit.
And there's that, we deal with bullshit.
Right.
Or probably more than anything else, we deal with bullshit.
I deal with it, and I create it as well. Yeah.
Create good bullshit.
Right.
So as far as creating bullshit, what other horror authors and other writers in general are you friends with, and how do they help you become a better writer?
Well, I would have to say pretty much everyone who's a part of the Denver Horror Collective and Denver Horror Writers. I mean, I can go through listing the names, but then I'd feel bad because I'd leave some out. So,
right.
But so we have about, it's like a little over a dozen folks who are regularly coming to these critique groups, actually a little more than that now, maybe about 15. And these are the folks that are the most important to me in terms of just what writers can do, how we can improve, how we can support one another. I know some local masters and stuff like that, but
yeah.
To me, that's they're almost less interesting to me. It's like, well, good for you. You're there, you did that. What is that process? What is that transition from fledgling to whatever that next stage of growth is, you know, like a massive hawk or a vulture, you know,
right.
Flapping across the canyon. So we have all these folks at different skill levels, different abilities and stuff like that, and it's a beautiful thing because it's like we see this gradation of the writer, for someone who's just starting to dabble in it, to folks who have been doing it for years. And I'm inspired by pretty much everyone, and I learn from everyone, even folks who maybe, you know, I've put more time into it than them, but I can see, okay, that's an important component that I actually missed in my own writing. So I love that. And I think just immersing yourself with, honestly, people who are, you know, far better than you. I think that's, they talk about, you're the product of the people you spend the most time with, blah, 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 blah. And I think it's good to spend time with folks whose skills are far superior to yours and all that, and you can right. learn from them. But I think you want to spend a lot of time around people who are at a similar level, and even being able to assist those who are maybe, you know, not quite at that level, because that teaching process really makes it firm in your mind. And it also, it's like you get everyone up that continuum, and I think that's super important.
What I've enjoyed most about the group, and I don't want to take it for granted, is for most of us, there just seems to be a genuine desire to help the person sitting next to them. You don't often get that with groups. So that was one of the reasons that I, you know, it was a great find as far as finding this group and staying with this group.
Yeah.
And I will just use this opportunity that since we didn't mention any names,
yeah.
if people want to know some of those names, go to denverhorror.com and you will learn some of those names.
Good, good. Good call right there. Yeah, check out the website. We have all the members' names listed there, and there are plenty of excellent folks. And it's, yeah, it's tremendous. It's definitely the best thing in my life in terms of, like, my writing. And it's that constant inspiration and also accountability. You know, it's like you're like, well, if you say you're going to hand something in on this date, you damn well better have it ready.
As far as what you have so far and looking to the future, do you want each thing that you write, doesn't matter if it's a short story, novel, flash fiction, whatever, to stand on its own, or are you trying to build a body of work with connections between each work?
Everything thus far has been in its own little splinter dimension.
Okay.
I think what I'm doing right now is I'm just testing out what worlds I like to belong to.
Okay.
And testing the creation of worlds. So yeah, thus far there's been no crossover with pretty much anything. I am certainly not averse to that, and at some point in time I would actually very much enjoy kind of dwelling in a particular universe. So my novel I just finished, Alpha Syndrome, that I'm putting out there, there's he's not the main character, but he's like a secondary character. His name is Vaughn, and he's kind of despicable, and I really like that character, and I just think it would be fun to have kind of like a prequel of how he got to be such a piece of shit. So I'm thinking about ways in which I can do that, but as of yet I have not gotten to that point.
And I wondered that about Vaughn myself, and I say that having read her work and being a member of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, Gary and I are particularly amused by Vaughn, because anytime we read sections of that story, we always bring up Vaughn.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, excellent. So going from that into franchises,
okay,
that seems to be, as far as mainstream publishing and with self-publishing, mm-hmm. there seems to be a huge push in that direction.
Right.
I'm not going to lie, it's very tempting. And this guy, me, I have a franchise, you know, in mind that I'd love to write. It is horror, probably what you'd call noir horror, action horror. But I have this fear that I'm going to get lost in it, and
yeah.
it's going to take me a while to get back to what I really love, which is art and doing something original each time.
Sure.
I don't know if that's unrealistic on my part. Franchises. Mm. How do you feel about franchises, and have you been tempted? Are you going to go that direction at any time? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I've given a little bit of thought to it. I mean, I think franchises are great. I mean, you inhabit a world, you want to keep hanging out there, right? You know, until it becomes crappy and then it kind of wrecks it. And you're like, oh, I wish they hadn't written that last book. But as long as it keeps strong, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it makes sense for the reader, because, yeah, they get to live in the world that they really like visiting. I think it makes sense for the writer, because they can further develop the characters. They've already kind of started and created this universe. Keep going. Makes sense for the publisher as well. You like this candy? Here's more of the same candy. So I don't have any issue with that. My thoughts for myself were just, that's a bit of hubris for somebody such as myself who has not sold a novel yet to be like, hey, I'm writing three novels for you. And it's like, well, why don't I sell one of them first? And then I'll worry about selling, you know, writing a trilogy or something like that.
Right.
And obviously, you know, the amount of time it takes to write a novel, you have to write three novels before you. So it's not like you have to write all of it in advance, but I'm afraid of biting off more than I can chew.
Gotcha.
But who knows? At some point, you know, I have no problem with that. And that prequel concept, you know, you can always go back, and I can always go for it. I guess the difference is, like, yeah, you got to end something on a note where it could kind of be torn open again, or like it's a scab that hasn't quite healed or something.
Right. Of course, you have to worry about all the Annie Wilkes of the world.
Misery Chastain cannot be dead.
Yeah.
That would be so flattering if somebody was that into my... So if there is an Annie Wilkes out there who wants to imprison me and make me write another novel, I mean, that would really help my work ethic.
Yeah, I always think about that, you know, and it's in the book as well, you know, that conversation that Paul has with his I guess it's his agent.
Yeah.
Lauren Bacall, in fact, wasn't she his agent
in the movie. Yeah.
But it's, you know, he's relaying all this tragedy to her. He's finally starting to talk about it. He's obviously just racked with PTSD, but and his agent is just salivating at all of it. It's like, you know, yes, it sucked to be you during that time, but this is pure gold. You know,
that's what I think. Anytime I'm out there and I'm afraid of like a monster or a murderer, and I was like, if I live through this encounter, it'll be like a best-selling book. So,
right.
Harvest the good stuff. Why not?
Excellent. So, if you could tell your younger writing self anything, what would it be?
Besides, suck less.
try not to suck as much.
Maybe I would have suggested to him that he be a little bit more on a regimen with the writing rather than just like when he felt like it.
I hear that.
But he had to do what he had to do, and he had a lot going on, and he was trying to figure shit out. So he, at least, who is me, kept the art up, and I think the process that I went through of, you know, poet, I use that because that sounds ridiculous for me to consider myself a poet, but I wrote poetry, songwriting, journalism, fiction writing, it's probably a necessary process, you know? So maybe it's fine the way it is.
What horror writers did you dislike at first, but grew into? Were there any that you had to grow into?
That is interesting. Right off the top of my head, nothing is coming to me. Basically, it kind of went the opposite. It was like writers I liked that I stopped liking as much that I started to like again because I saw what they were doing and valued it, even though it wasn't my voice. So, yeah, I mean, so the idea would be that you weren't into them and then you became into them. I can't think of one, honestly.
Interesting. Yeah, for the most, my own experience, if it's something that I'm just simply not enjoying, I'll put it down. Stop reading it.
Right.
The only one that I can think of that was an exception to that, and I think it was just because you were talking about some dense material to get into at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
But within the past few years, I grew an appreciation for was H.P. Lovecraft.
Okay.
that is... I'm telling you based on my own experience, okay? There's some people that, you know, once they start Lovecraft, you know, it's love at first sight, and they, you know, it's a done deal. I had to grow into Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is my way in is if you're going to pick a most reviled, or people tend to jump on the bandwagon and call it his weakest story, and I think it's great. And it's basically he kind of framed it as a Frankenstein ripoff, but it was Herbert West, Reanimator. That was the one, you know, he kind of downplayed, you know, to say the least. Well, I wrote it to get, but I did it, you know, for these, you know, commercial reasons.
Yeah.
I freaking loved it. So that's the only writer I can think of, you know, in regard to that.
That's really interesting. Yeah, because I was a huge Lovecraft fan from the start. I think, so at what age had you started reading him?
I started reading Lovecraft, when did they first start coming out with, so it was probably in late high school or probably just after high school. They started coming out with those paperbacks that had those cool paintings on them. And I think they might have been collected by S.T. Joshi, or anyway, Del Rey, I think, was the...
Sure.
The it just had those absolutely macabre paintings. When I think back now, most of them had nothing to do with the stories inside, but they conveyed that sense of dread, and they captured that Lovecraft spirit. Being an art dude, that's kind of what drew me in. And I can remember some paragraphs being great, but then just kind of getting lost, you know, and that might have been my age, maturity, you know. Once again, I'm speaking just for myself. In recent years, though, I picked up the complete H.P. Lovecraft, you know, at it was probably Barnes & Noble, you know, one of those hardback books where the type is just, you've got to get out a magnifying glass, you know, to read it, because it's got every freaking thing he ever did.
Yes.
And just got absorbed, just read it cover to cover. Now, by no means am I a Lovecraft expert, but just, you know,
but
it may
be that you were actually more sophisticated and you were able to pick out the stuff about Lovecraft that was very stilted and not good writing, because I was too young to realize a lot of it was not good writing. I was just captivated by the mood and the setting, and then it ended up being all my writing was that my high school English teacher was like, everything you write doesn't have to be like H.P. Lovecraft. And I was like, but it does. But so I think I wasn't sophisticated enough to understand his flaws, and maybe you did, and then you kind of realized, okay, despite this, here are the good things about him. And I read them now, and, you know, a lot of it is a bit dense, and I'm like, well, I would hoping I would never write specifically like that. But, you know, the essence of what H.P. Lovecraft has provided, I mean, I think we can't even downplay the contribution he's made to modern horror. Tremendous. Right. So I think you were right. You were right to be skeptical.
Yeah. Do you recall an early experience where you learned that written language had power?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Tell me all about it.
It's a secret. No. So the first evidence, I guess, I have of it, because I still have that relic somewhere in the drawer, was when I was 11, maybe 12, and like my puppy of like a year and a half. I'm not going to tell the whole story, the whole tearjerker. I usually save that for dates and stuff like that. But basically, I had a puppy a year and a half old, and he died. The vet botched the thing, and the dog died. Mm. And I was really torn up by it. And I remember writing some shit down, and like I think it was like angry at God, and I didn't even believe in God, but I was just, it was like, why would you take? And I looked at it more recently, and I realized, and I remember at the time just writing that down, the sorrow or the blaming of God, the blaspheming or whatever you want to call it, that actually helped siphon the emotions away from me onto the page and kind of make just process. And so then since then, you know, as a teenager or a preteen, girl troubles, stuff like that, just like, why does she do? I would just write for pages and I'd feel better afterwards. So it would be like unbearable, from unbearable almost to, well, at the time, to a 13-year-old boy, to, okay, I think it's okay. So I realized the power at that point, and probably ever since then, that's probably all I've been doing, just like purging my psyche. And I guess since then, I've like become a little bit more conscious and directed with it. But that, I think, is the essence of writing for me. Is it's like I do it because I have to, not because I want to.
Do you have, like, are there any important publications or broadcasts or podcasts out there that you would recommend to writers, and more specifically, horror writers? Are there any that come to mind? Were there any that helped you?
I will be the first to admit that I don't end up listening to a lot of writer podcasts. And I don't know why that is. I have no real reason not to. I have no excuse not to. I have nothing against them. That's just not what I end up gravitating towards when I listen to a podcast. It's sort of just far-flung different topics that I think will enhance just my imagination and whatever interest I have at the time. So I wish I had a list. And frankly, if you have some, those are the ones I should probably listen to.
Well, and it certainly wasn't a nudge in that direction. Hmm. Now, are there any publications? Are there any literary publications? And, you know, it could be more generally writing and not specifically horror writing.
I don't even... Now I'm realizing all these gaps in where I could... So I do... I go to conferences, and I've taken courses, and I've read several books and stuff like that. So I'm constantly working on my craft and with feedback. But I haven't been looking at a lot of, you know, new publications, probably partially because, I mean, if we're talking about some of like the literary magazines, because they all rejected me, so I canceled my subscriptions to those. So those are gone.
That plenty of times.
I would say the closest is the Emotion Thesaurus, which was recommended to me by a member of our group, Chris Phillips, who I was having trouble in some of my writing describing, say, anxiety, just in not writing the same way again, you know, about some sort of physical emotion, internal emotions, or seeing what the character does. Like, his brows furrowed. Like, I can't keep writing that. So I got the Emotion Thesaurus, I believe it's called, by Ackerman, and I can't remember the other person. And basically it goes through these different emotions, you know, anxiety, anger, disgust, and has all these internal responses and ways you can kind of play off of those. So that, I would say, has been useful. And then I have read many books on the topic, like countless books. But in terms of, you know, publications that come out regularly or podcasts, no, I'm pretty impoverished in that landscape.
Do you have a favorite underappreciated horror novel?
Does it have to be a novel, or can it be an author?
It could be an author.
Because I'm really into this guy who no one I know has ever heard of. And if they've heard of him, it's probably through me, and I don't know why. His name is Richard Gavin, and he hasn't written any novels. I don't know why he hasn't. To my knowledge, he hasn't. I've just seen his short story collections, and he is a horror writer up in Canada. And if I were to, and this has probably been said a lot of times about different people, but I never believe it, he seems to be like the heir to Lovecraft. So like the modern day Lovecraft, and taking it to the next level. So he's kind of like a writer like say Cormac McCarthy. So there are a bunch of writers out there, and I'll read books, and I'll be like, you know what? This is great. One day I might be able to make my craft as good as this. I read Cormac McCarthy, I read Richard Gavin, and I'm like, all right, I won't get to this level. That's okay. That's okay. This is like a they're doing something different. So he does something where it's like Lovecraftian fiction, and I would say his stuff actually falls under folk horror.
Okay.
I would say it probably would. And the thing that drew me to him, actually, I was just at a used bookstore in Boulder, leafing through the shelves, which is my favorite thing to do. I don't want to be recommended by an algorithm what I need to read. Like, I want to just go through or have people recommend stuff, you know? That's more organic than a computer telling me. That's so weird. So I just going through and I saw something, Sylvan Dread. I'm like, I like both of those words. And I pulled it out, this cool weird frontispiece with kind of almost like a pagan god on the front. Every fucking story in this short story collection, maybe dozen, 15, was about the forest in some way. And I'm obsessed with nature. So before I was a desert person, I was a forest person. Mm. I still am. And I would write all these stories. And I remember even in college, I was writing all these poems about forests. And my teacher was like, there's no way you can keep writing more poems about forests. And then I did. I wrote 10 more. So he pulled that off. And his stuff is just... The language is maybe a little at first a little hard to digest because it is literary. Like it's the edge of poetics there, but genuine dread, genuine fear, beautiful. He knows nature. So John, in the horror group, in our critique group, I'm the one who I call myself the self-appointed nature Nazi. So because I know ecology and landscape. So if somebody's something that's unrealistic, is this 3-hour thunderstorm in the mountains? No, thunderstorms pass through a lot quicker than that. So he gets everything right. He's a guy, if he doesn't spend a lot of time outside, I would be very surprised. And so Richard Gavin, Sylvan Dread is a great place to start. And sadly, some of his books are out of print. And I remember making a post once on social media, and I think I tagged him. I was like, in what kind of a world do we live in which any of Richard Gavin's books are out of print? And it just reminds me, it's like, just because something is awesome doesn't mean people will know that's the case.
Right. This is one thing that most artists, you never hear this. I mean, it's, and I'm not trying to get stoic on us in this moment, but as an artist, even if you are a great artist, there is a very good chance that you are not going to be recognized as a great artist until probably decades, maybe centuries after you're dead.
Yeah.
You will more than likely be in the ground by the time that one recognizes your greatness. If they do.
Yeah.
So, what's interesting is being faced with my own mortality, and like I said, not to get too stoic, but I had to adopt that attitude of if I'm enjoying what I'm creating, that's what I should be doing, art.
Yes.
Yes, success is wonderful. I'm not going to turn it away, but when it stopped being my driving force, then I actually began to see my art flourish at that point. Now, there's some artists that would be a lot less generous than I'm being with that statement. They're like, wow, fuck money. You know, just sell your soul to the, devil for your, creations and things like that. Which, I don't know that I necessarily, need to make that leap. I just want to have a healthy recognition of it's probably not going to happen, in this lifetime. However I want to look at it. So once I reached that, then yes, I was able to jump forward.
Well, that probably comes back to the ego thing. It's like your hands are not as tight on the reins, so you can kind of loosen up. Like if you're driving at the edge of a cliff and you're like, oh, I'm freaking out, I'm holding, you're more likely to plunge off the cliff. But if you're just like, it's cool, whatever, I can, I know how to drive, I'm not going to, and then you're loose, and then you're driving safer. So that's a weird analogy. But basically the idea is I think not obsessing about either. I think the obsession with a purity, it's like I will deliberately write things that no one will ever like. That's no good for everyone. We all want to be read.
Right.
But I personally believe in at least, paying attention to the compass a little bit and just like, okay, here's something purely from inside me where I'm at. I'm like, I'm not catering and I'm not pandering. And I put it out there. And I'm like, what do you think? And they're like, ew. I'm like, all right, fair enough. And I go back to the drawing board. All right, one little tweak that I can maybe do is not write about, this aspect as much or something like that. But still, then I put it back into, the cauldron that is me. And then whatever comes out is still going to be the pure me. What do you think about that? And it's like, yeah, we do like that. Cool. That's the way I go about it. And I'm trying not to, take either road, which maybe is not wise. I don't know. If somebody's listening to this who has better advice, tell me.
As a horror writer, what would you choose as your mascot slash avatar slash spirit animal?
Three different ones or all the same?
Any, you can pick any of those or all of them.
Well, I think of, you know, when people ask me if I have any tattoos and I say I don't, and then I say, but if I had a tattoo, what it would be the Green Man, which oddly enough in Richard Gavin's book comes into play and comes right into that folk horror component as well. So, you know, the Green Man, which is like, it's a man, he's kind of face made of leaves and sticks and stuff like that. He's basically like a tree guy, sort of like an ent from Tolkien, but not really. And so I would say that would be my mascot. It's like he's nature. He's kind of scary, and he can fuck you up if he needs to. But right. If you're cool with him, he's going to be cool with you. That's kind of how I go about things. Not that I go around fucking people up. But.
Right. How important is horror cinema and television to you?
Not as important as horror fiction. Okay. But I do like it. So the main thing I watch television or film-wise, it's either comedy or horror. So it's like 75% comedy. Hell, it's probably even more, like 80% comedy, 20% horror. I do like horror film. I do like several horror shows. But I don't feel like horror film does the same thing as horror fiction, like at all. Well, not. But I think horror film is very much, you know, the visual element, the jump scares, the kind of, there's more gross out stuff, it's all condensed, whereas horror fiction is more kind of about that mood and drawing it out and the setting. So I do like horror film, but I almost, yeah, I don't, like, my favorite books, I almost don't want them to make movies about.
Agreed. I'm the same way. There's just some, it's impossible to make that translation.
Yeah.
And I know that there's a belief that because streaming has become more popular, because you can clock more hours on a story and it creates more content and it makes Netflix happy, and then, okay, they'll be able to adapt the book closer. No, there's still some stories that you just can't make that leap onto the big screen or the small screen, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Some do make a good translation, but there are some that you just, you know, just to go back to that, you know, did you read the? And it drives people crazy, you know, nowadays. I mean, you've got, my God, Game of Thrones fans. You've got two crowds, you know, within that realm. You've got the book purists, and then you've got the show purists who are like, fuck the book people. You know, I watch this show because I watch it. There's a few out there that kind of have the balance of, you know what, I enjoy both. You know, don't.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's for myself, it's important, but I just don't. I don't want to be guided by it.
Yeah.
In other words, I don't want my writing to be guided by something that really belongs cinematically.
Right.
And when I think about some things that I really enjoyed on the screen, I find, horror-wise, I find out that they were written for the screen. Yeah, and that, there's a whole art to that.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, you know, they should stop making films about books. No, they go for it. And they're going to keep making
them. Oh, sure.
I find things that are written for the screen.
Yeah,
kind of toyed with it myself, but that's a whole other realm. It'd be interesting when if and when we do get a screenwriter in the group.
Yeah,
Which is something we would very much welcome. If you're thinking about it, once again, DenverHorror.com and the Denver Horror Collective on Facebook. Do you view writing as kind of a spiritual practice?
I haven't really thought of it in that way, to be honest. I would say therapeutic, sure, inspirational, but a spiritual practice, I haven't really considered it to be so, but that doesn't mean that it's not the case for me. I just haven't really explored that.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a spiritual practice necessarily, just for lack of a better word. I don't have the DSM in front of me or anything like that. Do you get any type of psychological relief or catharsis? Or
oh, yeah. I mean, like when I was talking about before, how it's like kind of purge me in my troubled times.
Right.
I think it's like people ask, oh, do you write stuff like, do you like writing? And it's like, you must write like writing. And I do. But it's like, I more like having written. Just like, you know, I go through my 45-minute sessions, which is kind of how I do. I just like do these 45-minute sessions. Just, wow, just go. And a lot of times I kind of lose myself, and it's like, wow, 45 minutes. So I guess in that sense, it is like I'm transcending boundaries of time and space, whatever. But it's kind of like afterwards, I'm just like, yeah, that felt good. So it's like, you know, you can get highs in lots of different ways in life. And, you know, you can use substances, and I have no problem with certain substances. And I use certain substances, all legal, of course, if anyone's listening. And the other thing you can do is you can set goals for yourself. and then meet those goals and then feel really good. Like, you know, I go to the gym 4 days a week, and I may not want to go to the gym, like, ever, and I don't really like the gym itself, but I'm done, and I'm like, that's why I do this. Okay, you know, and then obviously the result of going to the gym is good. It makes me healthy. So I would say, like, the after effect of just feeling great having written. So maybe I'm actually addicted in that. I'm addicted to the high of having written. I need help. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I can provide some help. Just write more, Josh.
Okay. First one's free.
Right. Feel as much or as little as you want to in regard to this, because I don't want to reveal any spoilers for your work. What was your hardest scene to write?
In my current novel or just in general of everything?
In general.
My hardest scene to write. Well, I'm thinking of, all right, so Viremia was a short story. I think that was my second one I sold, and it was in Campfire Tales by Dead Man's Tome. That came out, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I think. And so based on Callback to the Desert, I tried to write my first story kind of encompassing the beauty and the dread of the desert, because the desert is both the most gorgeous and horrifying landscape, you know, sometimes at the exact same time. You're like, oh my God, and you're saying it like in two different ways. And yeah. So I was like, I'm going to write a good part of this just kind of about the experience of going for a hike through the desert and kind of the feelings in that. And I remember one of the rejections I got from a publisher early on was, it just feels like the character is a woman. It's just hiking through the desert. And I'm like, no, exactly. I'm like, yeah, that was it. And I realized just because I accurately conveyed what it's like for me to walk through a desert does not mean it makes for interesting literature. Be aware that if you do purchase Viremia, there's a lot more than just the character walking through the desert. But that was me kind of putting my all into having that natural landscape in the setting and tying it into the atmosphere and the mood and then the plot itself. So I don't know if I was successful in doing it or not, but I know that was really difficult and continues to be to try to do that kind of thing.
Mm. Well, speaking of the desert and the oh my God factor in either direction with that,
yeah.
Let's talk about the landscape and also let's talk about folk horror.
Beautiful.
What's interesting is that the term first came out, if I'm not mistaken, in the early 70s, and it was used in regard to describe some films that were coming out at the time. And it has started to get traction, though, only within probably about, I'd say, the last, I don't know, 5 to 8 years. And what's interesting is genres, sometimes you have to have a little bit of history before things begin to fall into place, you know, as far as genre. And it's not that I have to categorize everything, but I'm very fascinated with folk horror. There seems to be some particular themes with it. I created an amalgam definition of it's a Frankenstein definition just by gathering different definitions of what it is to be quote-unquote American. Mm. What are we talking about by the word folk?
Right.
Very close relationship to the folklore.
Yes.
And then horror. So before we jump into it, just a brief recap. The folk horror, when you get it from the British, the English perspective, a lot of the films, stories, they have to do with nature, isolation, things like that. As far as the individual feeling isolated, you've got the landscape and the culture that he runs into. Example. A good American example of this would be the story Deliverance.
Right.
You're not just, you know, in that story, it's not just going to a different part of the country, it's a different planet.
Yeah.
Especially those who don't have experience going into it. Now, I know we've got different subgenres like nature horror, you know, and things like that. So you've got the landscape you're not familiar with, and then you've also got the culture that mm-hmm. you're not familiar with. Mm-hmm. The insider becomes the outsider. Mm-hmm. You are, in some respects, you are the monster. You are the other mm-hmm. of the story. When I say you, that could be first person. It could be, third person. The POV isn't so much important as the protagonist is alienated somewhat. Okay. So I'm going to read this giant amalgam of a definition,
yeah.
and I'm going to try and whittle this down over the coming months and probably years because I'm so fascinated with it. I'd really like to try to get a bead on it. Because I think we have something to say with our own American history in regard to it. So, American folk horror, what I've got here, once again, this is a copy and paste amalgam from drawing from Webster, Wikipedia, maybe a few encyclopedias on religion, but here goes. American folk horror, the historical, traditional, or popular bodies of myths, beliefs, customs, lore, and stories of a community, or relating to a particular place within North America, passed through generations by oral tradition, the written word, the visual arts, or other media. These bodies are intended to frighten, scare, disgust, or startle its audience by inducing feelings of horror and terror. What it occasionally shares with, in varying degrees, but is not limited to, its elder English and European folk horror siblings are characteristics of isolation in both the person and the community, a speciously rooted belief system, Gothic flavors, ancient religious influences. American folk horror can and does encompass folk traditions evolved in the North American continent post the 16th century arrival of Europeans. Although it contains some of Native American folklore, it should not be confused with any tribal beliefs of any community of Native people. Putting that into it, that last sentence into an American perspective, just imagining our first encounters, you know, with Native America and so forth. The examples they use, and I promise I'll end this soon, Josh, and then we can start talking about it.
Yeah.
There's a film called The Wicker Man. Have you seen The Wicker Man?
Well, I've seen both incarnations. It was like the 80s or 70s one, and then like Nicolas Cage was in it for some reason.
Right. The Nicolas Cage version is highly reviled. What's interesting is you've got some that actually like that film because they kind of look at it from a more artsy visual perspective. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, there's some stunning shots in there. You know, Cage is going to be Cage, which I'm going to hand it to the guy in this way. He's done so much work. Mm-hmm. He's ended up doing some very interesting things, which, stick out of my mind. It's a great movie. Getting back to folk horror, your affinity for nature, whether it be the desert, the forest, or whatnot. Can you think of any stories in particular that might fit into that mold? And at this point, it doesn't necessarily have to be American folklore. We'll get back to that in a second, but that you're like, you know, this might fit into that category.
Well, I mean, not to harp on Richard Gavin, but Richard Gavin does have several stories that I would say fall exactly into that, like with pagan influence and definitely landscape and myth passed down over the ages. Like, I don't even know if, like, maybe all of his stuff.
Okay.
That might be overestimation. But I would say, staying on a theme, so Lovecraft, so the Dunwich Horror, which is partially about one of his Lovecraftian monster creations, but to me that's the less interesting part of that story because a lot of it is in this decrepit New England backwater, and I grew up in around New England, so I kind of identify with all that. And basically these decayed versions of a particular family, and one of them sort of like a wizard guy, and they're just like living in squalor, and then they're practicing this old religion. So I would say that based on the definition you read, that the Dunwich Horror by H.P. Lovecraft has elements of folk horror. And then it goes into Lovecraftian cosmic horror, of course, because Lovecraft's got to be Lovecraft.
Right. When you're talking about England and Europe, of course, a lot of what plays into their folk horror, ancient druids, you know, the Celtic practices just before and a little after the church shows up.
Right.
In that culture and things like that. Here in the U.S., the story that springs to mind for me, there was a film called Bone Tomahawk. Kurt Russell starred in it. If I'm clear on it, it filmed right around during the time he did The Hateful Eight. And so he still got the full-on Western cut, you know, beard and mustache. I mean, just the biggest, bushiest thing you've ever seen. And long story short is they encounter a tribe like nothing they've seen before, and this turns in quickly into a horror story, full-on horror story. No supernatural elements whatsoever, but just absolutely when they begin to pursue, not revealing too much about the film, that's one I will keep spoiler-free. It's such a clash of cultures that it can't be anything except horrifying and terrifying.
Yeah.
Have you not necessarily encountered a different culture in isolation, but in your hiking, traveling, whatnot, you in the wild, was there ever a terrifying experience? Now, those of you who can't see us right now, he's chuckling, so I'm sure there's... I don't know if there's been more than one with you, or think of one particular instance where you were like, man, I'm not going to make it. And maybe describe that for me.
Okay. So I think of one in particular. Yeah, I don't know if this would qualify as folk horror in that, yeah, I didn't encounter any other creatures or even individuals or, you know, they're... A lot of the definitions don't necessarily apply, but if we're talking about landscape and horror and fear and then I would say sure. So I went to this place called The Maze, which is been called by Backpacker Magazine the most dangerous hike in America.
Okay.
It's not. It's really not.
And but your first thought was, I got to do that.
Because of Ed Abbey, yeah. That bastard, and he made it seem so tempting. So basically, it's a part of Canyonlands National Park, but it's separated from the rest of it. So the normal Canyonlands that, if you're listening to this, that you probably know, you have to drive about 200 miles to get to this spot. So basically, you go on the highway, past anywhere you know for a while, then you take 50-mile more desolate highway, then you take about 45 miles on kind of a dirt road to get to the most remote ranger station in the continental U.S., and then you take a road, which I use in quotations, which for a Jeep is not a big deal. For my Subaru was kind of pushing it, so it's like about 20 miles that take like, I think it was like an hour and a half, like it, all rocks and whatnot, and then starts, it's called the Burr Trail, so it's a Jeep trail. My Subaru doesn't do that, so I took a bicycle into it. So I rode my bicycle down a mountain bike, and I had my backpack on and everything. And basically, I got to a place down there, and I'm not even going to describe the landscape. Read Ed Abbey if you want the landscape description. But it's one of the most remote places you can get, certainly in any national park, but just in general. It's just there's nothing and there's nobody. Mm. And it's not a good idea to go on your bike. And I wrote an article about it, and just, yeah, don't do what I did. But so I went in there pretty far by myself, and it was hotter than it should have been that time of year, and I was getting a bit sweaty, and I was starting to get the edge of kind of heat exhaustion, maybe, but I won't belabor it. But basically, I was fighting with my mind as to whether or not the symptoms I was feeling were real, or if I was just being neurotic about a situation, or being smart because I'm in the middle of nowhere by myself, and it's like 90-something degrees, and it's burning hot Utah. So I was mostly, the struggle was in my own brain, and then what the ranger had previously told me about all these other horror stories that had happened around the area, which I realized later she'd exaggerated everything, but that kind of stuck in my mind, and I got to the point where I was like, I wanted to get to this one arbitrary location, and I was like, Ed Abbey would go there, and I'm like, are you being a wimp, Josh? And basically, I ended up just hanging out under the shade and doing the smart thing and not pushing myself. So that was kind of like my existential crisis. No actual creatures, no beings, no, it was, so like the old thing they teach you in English class is like man versus nature, man versus man, man versus nature, man versus himself. It was basically man versus himself and a little bit of man versus nature. But an interesting thing that could tie into even a better folk horror story, and I've thought about this, and people, if you want to steal this idea, whoever's listening, or John, go for it. So I looked up later, because I talked to the ranger. I was like, well, yeah, no one's ever died out here. She's like, actually, two people had died. And I had done my research, and I hadn't found that. I was like, that's interesting. So I researched it later. And basically, yes, a father and son had gone out there maybe, I don't know if it was 10 years ago, maybe less, and they never returned, which is true. They died out there. And it still remains a mystery to this day, because apparently somebody has saw them fighting, but they were, you know, a beloved father and son, that, you know, they had a good relationship. Right. But they both were dead of a gunshot wound. And they walked out into like the middle of nowhere place. And some people are proposing that, well, that the father had intended to kill the son, but then they had like beers back in the cooler waiting for them in the car. So it's kind of like this mystery in like one of this most remote places in the world. But I almost think what's, to me, the most interesting component of that is, and because I try to, and I love nature horror, and I write about nature horror, nature is kind of like the last thing that's out to get you. Like, it may not care about you, and it may just let you die, but it's not going to go out of its way to kill you. They went to this area, the most dangerous hike in America, that no one has ever died because of the elements. The only people who died there were a father, son, one of whom, either as a double suicide, they hurt themselves or each other. It's like, so the humans brought out into this supposedly devil's landscape, you know, everything's like the devil's rock and the devil's tomb, and it's right. Like, no, the nature is pretty wholesome, and there's some water there, and there's shade, and there's even food if you know how to look for it. But we kind of bring that darkness into the landscape, and that's all I got to say about that.
Absolutely. Well, in your description of it, from what I gather, that's exactly what folk horror is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got the landscape tied into just the isolation. There's the possibility of coming upon a community, maybe some odd rituals. not an easy community to extricate yourself from. A lot of these stories are people go looking for missing people. Many times it's on an island that's not easy to get to, or when you get there, the culture might be pre-industrial or just barely getting by, you know, with what they have. You know,
right.
You're not going to be getting there on a motorboat. It's probably going to be a rowboat, you know, and not a trustworthy one at that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, there's just this, the critics of even having a category of folk horror is like, well, that's just horror. It's like, well, no. It's it may come off initially as like trying to describe the colors of a rainbow, you know, or something like that.
Right.
And then there's even some critics that are like, well, I folk horror exists. I only know it when I see it. But I actually think this is one instance where you can try and get it into a test tube and kind of examine it and look at it. They've been trying to do that for some time. Thinking of the story that you told me, some of the folk horror stories that I've read, very similar, if not identical. You know, it's even sometimes it's the nature challenge. And then what happens is, if there's a supernatural element, sometimes there's an overlay with maybe hallucinations going on in their own mind because of dehydration or whatever, you know, the factor is. That is left kind of vague. You know, it can be made worse. Or sometimes the mind, when deprived of something, tends to go on its own acid trip, you know, at that point.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's I find it fascinating, and I wanted to, in this opening podcast for James After Midnight, begin a discussion on it. Out of the research that you did, was there anything that stuck out to you as far as, like, wow, I'd like to check that out, or you were like, I remember that, and that fits?
In terms of folk horror?
Yeah, in terms of folk horror.
Well, somebody who definitely, I think, qualifies, and I haven't read much of his stuff, but I want to more now, understanding kind of this definition a little better. So, Ramsey Campbell.
Oh, okay.
And
yes,
that's, like, old school pagan. I don't know if all of his stuff or most of his stuff. The one book that I had read was all about that, and I was always into druids and pagan stuff, not like actually worshiping pagan gods, but I was into all that sort of stuff when I was younger, like elves and fairies, and I think that transitioned into more of horror, even though that my mom's Stephen King influence was always in the back of my mind.
Right.
So I was really struck by this, like, yeah, English town, desolate situation. I don't even remember which book it was or even really what happened for the most part. I just remember the feeling of, you know, desolation and dread and in the remote English countryside. And I've been over to Ireland, and so that kind of was able to come true. I was able to better picture that, like, that rugged, spare landscape, which really does, I can see how it has created a particular genre, even though, you know, obviously it's moved over the ocean to us.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So much of history is tied up with folk horror. And sometimes it's our lack of knowledge of history that kind of in these folk horror stories that exacerbates, you know, the situation.
Right, good point.
In this age of, I'm looking forward to writers diving into it, because in this age of Google, where we all think we know everything about everything, there's the whole quotient of, even if you do absorb what you pick up on Google, is it always good? Is it always accurate?
Right.
And then there's the whole wisdom factor of, well, how do you apply that intelligence? You know, how do you take that out into the world with you? Is something as simple as your Swiss Army knife going to save you, or is it going to be, this is a particular specter that goes away if I do this spell, you know, or something like that. So that part I find fascinating in regard to folk horror.
Mm-hmm.
Before we close this out, any final thoughts?
Final thoughts. It's like I'm about to die. My last words. I just love to hear from people about not just my writing, but writing in general.
Okay.
So I think, yeah, definitely encouraging folks to get involved with Denver Horror Collective, our upcoming anthology. Check out my stuff. You can check out my fiction or just sign up for my newsletter at joshsworstnightmare.com. I'm on Facebook, Josh's Worst Nightmare, Twitter, Josh's Nightmare. And just engage in the horror community, because what I don't really like social media, but I found that the horror community has been the most welcoming. Like, I've been a part of activist communities and journalist communities and all sorts of stuff. I enjoy most the social media is around the horror community. So I would say get engaged if you're a reader or a writer, or you want to do one or the other or whatever. You don't even know how to read. Like, just engage to some level in that horror community. And it's like, I think horror has some of the most potential to just, I don't want to use the word purity because that's not actually what I mean. What I'm trying to say is that horror is kind of a wide open alley and you can bring whatever you want into that. And I think for the most part, it's pretty welcoming. Like if you're writing detective stuff, you better do a particular thing. You kind of got to follow certain rules there. Romance, same thing.
Right.
But horror, it's like you can kind of do whatever the hell you want. And it was like, is that horror? It's like, it is if you say it is. If you can have an argument that it's horror, it's in. So, and you don't have to be some weirdo, but it helps.
Yes. Weirdness does help. Yeah, like you said, Josh, there's so much behind that word horror.
Yeah.
So in finishing this up, let me just ask you that. Normally this is the first question. On these horror podcasts, a question of this nature is normally like the first question. Mm-hmm. I'd like to make it the last one.
Yeah.
So Josh, what is horror?
I think it's the shadow. I think it's the darkness, you know, that can't exist without light and vice versa. I don't think it's about being morbid or wanting to kill yourself or any really even negative, unwholesome influences. I think it's about honestly assessing that side of life. And I am most afraid of the people who can't handle any element of it. Not, you know, so obviously some people have been through trauma and that's fine. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people who are just, no, everything's fine. Everything's fine. It's like, you're a murderer. Like, I worry about the folks who can't touch consciously into that element because it's there. It's there no matter what, whether you repress it or not, it's there. So like, how do you make peace with it? It's like, you know, that monster in the corner there. It's like, he lives in your house. It's like, you're not going to chase him out. You've learned what it likes to eat and it might not tear you apart that way.
That's great. Well, you've been listening to Jameis After Midnight. Thank you so much, Josh, for this conversation.
Thank you. It's great.
I hope I didn't wear out our voices entirely tonight, but I certainly enjoyed it. And until next time, listeners, keep the midnight oil burning and keep writing. Thank you, Josh. Thank you for joining us here at Jameis After Midnight. To find out more about me, Jameis Wilkes, all you have to do is go to jameis.com. That's jeamus.com. This program is co-sponsored by the Denver Horror Collective and Autumn Tiger Publishing Arts. To learn more about Denver Horror Collective, go to denverhorror.com. To see Autumn Tiger Publishing's offerings of my ebooks, search Jameis Wilkes on the Amazon Kindle store. Until next time, keep the midnight oil burning, you horror creatives, you.